So the topic for this week is the fourth habit in Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. So the topic is think win-win. So the first source here is from Covey on page 217. He defines win-win. So win-win is a frame of mind and heart that constantly seeks mutual benefit in all human interactions. Win-win means that agreements or solutions are mutually beneficial, mutually satisfying. And it's not the same thing as a compromise, which he goes on to explain later on, because in a compromise, even though compromise is good, you know, because each party, you know, gets something in terms of what they want, also each party sort of gives in partially when there's a compromise. So compromise is good when necessary, but he points out that here he's talking about something slightly different. He's talking about where they can create a third alternative, and you know, we'll see in a minute, a third alternative which everyone is basically entirely happy with. They don't feel like they're compromising. So he says, with a win-win solution, all parties feel good about the decision and feel committed to the action plan. Win-win sees life as cooperative, not a competitive arena. And I underline that because I think that's basically his main point, seeing life as cooperative. You know, if two people work together, you know, they can achieve a better result than if they feel like they're competing with the other person.
It sounds like in a good marriage.
Yes, that's a perfect example. Yeah, for sure. So if both spouses work together, you know, and cooperate rather than competing in any way, so then obviously that'll yield the best results. Most people tend to think in terms of dichotomies, strong or weak, hardball or softball, win or lose, but that kind of thinking is fundamentally flawed. It's based on power and position rather than on principle. Win-win is meaning, I think what he's saying there is that a person who has power and has position, you know, can think of, you know, the fact that, you know, I guess they can make demands and their demands may be fulfilled because of their power and their position, but it's not necessarily what's, you know, ultimately the right way to do things. Win-win is based on the paradigm that there's plenty for everybody, that one person's success is not achieved at the expense or exclusion of the success of others. Everyone can be successful. It doesn't mean just because one person's successful, someone else isn't. Win-win is a belief in the third alternative. It's not your way or my way. It's a better way, a higher way. So the first example of a Torah source that I thought is a great, I guess, metaphor for this happens to be more from a negative perspective in terms of here people were cooperating to do something wrong, but it still is a great example of cooperation. So the Gemara here in Sanhedrin says, and I translated it underneath, but the translation is mine, and it might not be, you know, absolutely perfect. So I'm going to read it in Hebrew and translate it. Amrei Antoninus l'Rabbi. So Antoninus said to Rabbi, Gufu neshama yecholin liftor atzman min hadin. That a person's body and soul can ultimately, you know, argue with God and exempt themselves from judgment. Ketzad, how are they going to do that? Gufomer, the body will say, Neshama chatas, it's my soul that sinned. Shemiyom shepir shemimeni, once my soul left me, once a person passes away and their soul leaves them, Hareini mutal ke'evan domein bekever, they lie silent in the grave once their soul leaves them, so they can't, you know, they can't sin. So the body claims, it's my soul that sinned. Uneshama omeres, and the soul claims, Guf chata, it's the body that sinned. Shemiyom shepirashti mimenu, the soul says, once I left the body, hareini parachas ba'avir ketzipor, I'm like flying in the sky like a bird, I haven't been sinning since I left the body, so each one says it's the other one's fault. So Amalei, so Rebbe answered and said, Emshel l'chamashal, I'll tell you a parable, to what can this be compared? Omer adar adome. Lamelech Basar Vadam, to a king, a human king, Shayaro Pardes Noah, he had a beautiful orchard. Vahayabo Bechoros Noos, and it had some first fruits that were beautiful first fruits. Vahoshib Boshne Shomrim, he appointed two guards. Echad Chiger Vechad Suma, a lame guard who couldn't walk and a blind guard who couldn't see. Now, why he would appoint those types of guards is an excellent question. You know, it's not the types of guards I would appoint. Maybe he had an alarm system. He didn't have to worry about anything. But so Amar lo chiger resuma. So the lame one said to the blind one, "Bechoros naos ani ro beparadis. I see these beautiful first fruits in the orchard." So the one who was able to see, but he couldn't walk, said, no problem. He suggested, I'll, you know, ride on the shoulders of the one who can walk, but is blind. You put the two together, they can accomplish whatever they want. Rachav chiger agave sumas, the lame one rode on the blind one. Ve'hevi'im va'achum, and they, you know, split the fruits. They brought them and they ate them. Liyamim ba'bara paradise. Eventually, the owner, the king, the owner of the orchard came back. Amar lahen, b'choros noos heichan hein, where are my wonderful fruits? Amar Ochiges, the lame one said, Chum Yeshri Ragayim Lahalech Bahen, do I have legs that I could go ahead and get them? How can you think it was me? I couldn't have done it. Amar Osuma, the blind one said, Chum Yeshri Einayim Liros, do I have eyes to see? It couldn't have been me, I can't see anything. Ma'asa, so what did the king do? This king was pretty smart. Hirkiv chigir agave suma, so he put the lame one on the blind one, v'dano sam ke'echad, and he judged them together, because together they could have done it. So too, says Rabbi, afa kadosh baruch hu mevi neshama v'zorka b'guf, so too God will take a person's soul, put it back in the body at the time of the revival of the dead in the future, v'dano sam ke'echad, and then we'll be judged together. The body and the soul will be judged together. So, when I translated this, I wrote at the bottom, while this example is about cooperation for sin, so the body and the soul cooperate to do mitzvos as well. We cooperate to do good things too. So this is a perfect example where you can have one person who has one particular skill, but a different weakness, and someone else has the opposite skill and the opposite weakness. The two of them join together and they can accomplish getting what they need. So I think it's a wonderful example of, you know, this isn't like a compromise. This is a third alternative. This is something which makes both of them happy. They cooperated, you know, and now both of them are happy. Both of them got what they wanted. Another example of cooperation, we can see here in the second source, the pasuk says, "Semach zvurun b'tzeisecha v'yisachar ba'alecha," that zvurun should rejoice and be happy in his going out, and yisachar in his tents. So Rashi explains, "Zvurun v'yisachar asu shutfas." The zvurun and yisachar made a partnership. Zvulun l'chof yamim yishkon, Zvulun would travel out to sea, v'yotzei l'pkak matya b'sfinos, and he would do business, u'mistakir, and he would profit in his business, v'nosin l'soch piv shel Yisachar, and he would feed, provide support for Yisachar, v'heim yoshvim v'oskim b'torah, and Yisachar would sit and learn, v'fichach hiktim Zvulun l'Yisachar, and that's why Zvulun is mentioned before Yisachar, sh'toroso shel Yisachar a'idei Zvulun ha'isa, because the learning that Yisachar did, the Torah study that Yisachar was involved in, was only as a result of Zvulun providing for his needs, and therefore Zvulun is mentioned first. So here you have another example of a partnership. One person was better at doing one thing, someone else was better at doing something else, and they teamed up and shared the rewards. Kobi goes on to explain that when a person feels a pressure to make some type of deal, so then that pressure prevents them from really pursuing a proper win-win, because they feel like, you know, I have to get something done, and then they're not able to properly accomplish what they want to accomplish. And therefore what he suggests as the best alternative is what he calls win-win or no deal. So I have a quote here from page 224. If these individuals, he's talking about people who are, you know, involved in negotiations, and he says that if these individuals had not come up with a synergistic solution, one that was agreeable to both, they could have gone for an even higher expression of win-win, known as win-win or no deal. No deal basically means that if we can't find a solution that would benefit us both, we agree to disagree agreeably. No deal. In other words, if we can't find an agreement which serves this third alternative, which is, you know, great for both of us, so then there's no pressure. We don't have to get involved in a deal which is going to leave both of us unhappy. Right? When you have no deal as an option in your mind, you feel liberated because you have no need to manipulate people. You don't need to force a deal on anyone. You have no need to manipulate people, to push your own agenda, to drive for what you want. You can be open. You can really try to understand the deeper issues underlying the positions, and the reason for that is that there's no pressure. You know, there's a person can just, you know, objectively stand back without feeling a pressure to accomplish a deal because they always have the option of not arriving at a deal. Now, he goes on to explain when describing this that this isn't always an option, meaning sometimes you can already be, you know, in a situation where no deal isn't an option. For example, the example that you mentioned of, let's say, a marriage, you know, two spouses. So win-win or no deal isn't an option. You know, it's a person's spouse. You know, they can't say no deal. But, you know, sometimes when no deal is an option, that prevents, you know, a person from feeling the pressure to enter into an agreement that they don't really want. I was not able to think of a Torah source specifically for win-win or no deal. If anyone has any ideas, they are definitely appreciated. Okay, so moving on to the next, basically what Kobi does in this chapter, just to give an overview, is he describes win-win and why it's ideal, and then he goes through the other permutations. There's win-lose, there's lose-win, and there's lose-lose, and then he divides win-win into five different steps that he thinks are necessary to achieve win-win. So after he goes through win-win and explains why that's the optimal way to do things, then he goes through the other three examples, win-lose, lose-lose, and lose-win, and explains why, you know, they're less than ideal. So continuing on to win-lose. So here at the bottom of the first page, on page 217, he writes, in leadership style, win-lose is the authoritarian approach. I get my way, and you don't get yours. Win-lose people are prone to use position, power, credentials, possessions, or personality to get their way. Whatever, you know, gives them the upper hand over the other person, they'll use that to get what they want. Most people have been deeply scripted in the win-lose mentality since birth. When one child is compared with another, and he gives a number of examples, basically of competition, which is why I highlighted or underlined, you know, that sentence in the first source here, that win-win sees life as cooperative and not as a competitive arena. Win-lose is basically seeing life as a competitive arena, and the examples that he gives are when one child is compared with another, so that creates competition, or within a peer group, this competition, who's going to be the most popular person in the class, in the academic world, right, who's going to get ahead in school, etc., athletics, who's going to win the championship, and law, there's a winner and there's a loser, right? Most of life, he says, is, and what's wrong with the win-lose mentality? So what's wrong with it, he says, is that most of life is an interdependence, not an independent reality. We live life in an interdependent world, right? Interacting with other people. Most results you want depend on cooperation between you and others. And the win-lose mentality is dysfunctional to that cooperation. I mean, basically, a person can use their upper hand to get what they want in the short term, but in the long term, they're just going to be harming themselves. People, you know, might not like them. They're going to, you know, damage their own personality by acting in a way which is, you know, not appropriate, too demanding, whatever it may be. So, in terms of finding sources for the downside of competition, so it wasn't too hard to think of that, especially with the upcoming Parshios, right? We know the story of Yosef, that Yaakov gave Yosef the ketones pasim, right, the coat of many colors. As a result, his brothers were jealous of him, and he was, you know, sold down to Egypt into slavery, and as a result, you know, all of the Jewish people became slaves in Egypt for many years. So what the Gemara says in Shabbos, based on this story, here in source 3, V'amar Rav Bar Machsaya, Amar Rav Chama Bar Guria, Amar Rav, so they all said, La'olam al yishana adam b'no b'en abanim, a person should never show favoritism to one child amongst their children. And by the way, this is a powerful way of saying it. La'olam al yishana, a person should never, right, show favoritism to one child over the other children. Shebishvil mishkal shnei sla'im melas, because of this extra, you know, wool coat that the shenasan Yaakov liYosef, that Yaakov gave to Yosef, Yosef mishar banav, beyond what he gave to the other children, niskanu bo echav, his brothers became jealous of him. V'nisgalgel hadavar v'yardu avoseinu l'mitzrayim, in the end of this, one thing followed another, and the end of the story was that we went down to Egypt and we were slaves there for many years. So we clearly see the dangers of competition within a family setting. What about within academics? So Covey had pointed out that competition within academics is no good. So then it's already more complicated within Torah sources, because there's a Gemara in Baba Basra here in source 4, V'amar Rava, Hai Mikri Yanuki Degaris. If you have a teacher who's learning, V'ika Achrina Degaris Tfeimine, and a different teacher who learns more than him, Romis Alkinan Rei, we don't remove the first teacher from his position, the one who learns less, because Dilma Asiris Rashule, if we appoint the one who learns more, he'll sort of become complacent. He'll feel like I'm the best, and he's not going to put in sufficient effort. And Rav Dimi Minahada'am, and Rav Dimi disagrees. And he says, Kol Shekein Degaris Tfei, for sure he's going to learn more, because Kina Sofrim Tar Bechachma, the jealousy, literally of scribes, but the jealousy of teachers of Torah, will increase wisdom. And the way Rashi explains that is, if you're going to remove one teacher and appoint the other teacher because they're, you know, learning more, so the one who's appointed isn't going to be complacent, wow, I'm the best, I don't need to worry about it. He's going to think, listen, they just took away this guy's job because I was doing better. He's really going to, you know, start getting into the race, and he's going to challenge me, so I better make sure to stay ahead. And as a result, both of them are going to be competing, and, you know, it's almost like competition in business. It brings down the prices, you know, and it's good because everyone's trying to be the best. So maybe competition in Torah is also good. Everyone's going to be putting in extra effort. So at first glance, that's what it seems to be saying. The competition in academia perhaps is good. It'll facilitate, you know, increased effort in accumulating knowledge. But there are many who point out that not so fast. So I brought here in source 5, it's from a Sefer Daf HaRadaf, which is a compilation. It was put together relatively recently. And he says, Kina Sofrim Tar Bechachma, Hainu Dafka Kshe Yilmar HaMekane Mimasav HaTovim Shel HaMasa. If there's jealousy, and that's going to cause the one who's jealous to try and be a better person, to learn from the good actions of the other one, so that's great. But not if the person who's jealous then sort of bemoans the fact that the other guy is a better person than him. Meaning, I see someone who's better than me, and that's going to motivate me to be, you know, to do as many good things as he does, that's good. But another possibility is I'm going to say, he does so many more good things than me, so I'm just bemoaning the fact that he's better than me. You know, I wish he was a little bit worse. You know? So then, obviously, it's not a good thing. V'shamati meharav ha-kadosh bala imrechai mi-vizhnit. So the Vizhnitzer Rebbe says, Shabir b'meni keres ha-kina ha-ba mi-tzena kedusha l'kina sh'ba mi-sitra achra rachmana l'tzlan. How do we know when jealousy is caused, is through holiness, when jealousy is a good thing? And how do we know when jealousy is a terrible thing coming from, you know, the other side, so to speak, the Russian of the sitra achra, it's coming from the other side, it's a bad thing. V'amar d'harei yadua Ashirim. We know that the communists equated everyone. People had more money, so they took away from them and they gave to the poor, and everyone was equal. They wanted everyone to be 100% equal. No one would have more than anyone else. And he says that that's not ideal. What they did was, out of jealousy, they took away from those who had. By the way, he's not saying that charity is a bad thing. Of course, charity is a good thing. But what he's saying is that out of jealousy, what the communists did was they took away everything that the wealthy people had. Without a jealousy, I want to do the good that the other person does. Not that I want him to do less. So that's ultimately the question. Ultimately the question is, if I'm jealous, is it that I want him to do less so I can feel better about myself? Or I want to do more because I really like, you know, the good things that he's doing. So jealousy can be good or jealousy can be bad. But it would seem to me that when jealousy creates a sense of competition, that would be part of the type of jealousy that it's not so good. Because competition is, I want to win and I want him to lose. That's what competition is. The positive jealousy is one where I want to be as good as him, right? That's not competition. It's not that I want to be as good as him because I want to be better than him. It's because I want to do the good things that he does. But jealousy that leads me to wanting to be better than him, which is competition, that's a negative type of jealousy. Fine. So that's all why the perspective of win-lose is not ideal. Competition just causes fighting, causes hard feelings, and that's not ideal. What about lose-win? So why would anyone take the approach of lose-win? So Covey explains here, page 220. He says, people who think lose-win are usually quick to please or appease. They seek strength from popularity or acceptance. If everyone likes me, then I'll be strong. They have little courage to express their own feelings and convictions and are easily intimidated by the ego strength of others. Lose-win means being a nice guy, even if nice guys finish last. Yeah, like, I know I'm going to lose out, but I'll do it anyways because then people will like me. But the problem is that lose-win people bury a lot of feelings. And unexpressed feelings never die. And it'll come back to haunt them. They're buried alive, meaning the feelings are buried alive and come forth later in uglier ways. Psychosomatic illnesses, particularly of the respiratory, nervous, and circulatory systems, often are the reincarnation of cumulative resentment, deep disappointment, and disillusionment represented by the lose-win mentality. Person gives in consistently, it'll eventually cause them to, it's all pent up inside them, and it's going to cause them to have issues. Disproportionate rage or anger, overreaction to minor provocation, and cynicism are other embodiments of suppressed emotion. People who are constantly repressing, not transcending feelings toward a higher meaning, find that it affects the quality of their self-esteem and eventually the quality of their relationships with others. So I was not able to find Torah sources which directly refer to his point, that if a person gives in frequently, it'll lead them to having pent-up feelings, which will explode at a later time. If anyone has ideas for that, I definitely welcome them. There are plenty of Torah sources which talk about a person's obligation to take care of themselves. Meaning the problem of lose-win is that a person's always giving in and they're not, you know, taking proper care of themselves. So one example is when it comes to lost objects. If a person has the opportunity to either return someone else's lost object or to spend that time retrieving their own lost object, then it's one or the other. If a person has the opportunity to do both, that's great. But let's say, I don't know, they're both being taken downstream, you know, and I have time to jump in to save either my object or someone else's object. So the Gemara says that one's own object takes precedence. And the Gemara says here in source 6, Minohani Mili, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Amar Kra, the Pasuk says, Efes ki lo yeh becha evyon, that there will not be any poor people amongst you. But the Gemara understands this with a drasha to mean lo yebecha evyon, there won't be poverty in you, meaning shalcha kodem v'shalcha adam, you're taking care of yourself, your own lost object takes precedence to someone else's lost object because you have a responsibility to see to it that you don't become poor yourself. Now the Gemara goes on to say, I'm just going to take this source sheet. I took notes on my source sheet before I sent it to the shul to print out, and I made some changes on the source sheet that you have in front of you, so I should have the same one. So then the Gemara goes on to say, "V'amarav Yehuda amarav koha mekayim ba'atzmo kaf sof bali dekaf." Anyone who's very insistent when it comes to this will ultimately become poor, almost as a punishment from God. In other words, even though, well, let's see Rashi first for an explanation of that. Rashi says here in Source 7, Koha mekayim ba'atzmo kaf, afal pi shelo hitihu alav hakosav. Even though it's not a person's responsibility to take care of someone else's property before their own, a person should still be a little more easygoing and not always insistent, mine comes first, mine comes first. He shouldn't be so insistent all the time. Unless it's clear, absolutely clear, that they really do stand to lose. If a person's always saying, you know, I come first, then he's removing from himself the yoke of the responsibility of doing kindness and charity, the sofshiyat stayach of rios, and ultimately he's going to need other people's assistance himself. So, on the one hand, a person has a responsibility to take care of themselves and their own property first. On the other hand, a person shouldn't, you know, take this to the extreme of always saying, you know, mine comes first, you know, when it's not really necessary and when they really could, you know, use their time to help someone else out also. Also, when it comes to giving tzedakah or even to doing any mitzvos, so Chazal say hamivaz, on the top of the next page, hamivazbez al yivazbez yoser mechomesh, that a person should not give more than one-fifth of their property to charity. And Rashi explains that if a person gives more than one-fifth to charity, here in Source 9, mechomesh ebenechasav shelo yitzdarech ebrios, we don't want a person to become poor themselves. Their first responsibility is to themselves.
I'm sorry, just a question. I thought that you're supposed to give 10% for tzedakah.
Yeah.
So, that's like a tenth.
Right, meaning 10% is a tenth, so that's
a fifth.
Yeah, so don't give more than a fifth.
Okay. It's
so
yeah.
The concept of an, I know this is not a shiur on tzedakah, but isn't there a concept of an asher muflag?
Yes.
Somebody who is, you know, today we're called, like, we're wealthy, so... Is that maximum of a fifth applicable to them too?
So no, it doesn't. Good point. Right. The Shulchan Aruch, I think it's in the Shulchan Aruch, but it definitely says somewhere that a person who is extraordinarily wealthy is allowed to give more than a fifth. Yeah, meaning Bill Gates is allowed to give more than a fifth because he'll still be left with more than enough and he still doesn't have to worry too much about, you know, impoverishing himself.
Right.
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
Good. Good point, yes.
Is that that concept of like the mask that they say on the plane, that if the mask comes down, you can give yourself first and you give to somebody else?
Excellent, yes. Yeah, take care of yourself first. And I think a component with, I mean, I don't know so much about safety in general, but I think a component of that is you'll better be able to care for the other people whose masks you need to put on if you're already secure. So, and that...
Never in that situation, because I'm going to faint tomorrow.
I'm sure you'll be safe. Yeah, the statistics are definitely in your favor, so, you know. Fun. So, okay. So now, even though a person should take care of themselves first, so Kovi points out here on page 222, if you value a relationship and the issue isn't really that important, you may want to go for lose-win in some circumstances to genuinely affirm that the other person. And that basically means to say, what I want isn't as important to me as my relationship with you. Let's do it your way this time. And I think the difference between that and giving in all the time is that the person here recognizes that the decision they're making is in their own benefit. Meaning a person who constantly gives in and feels like they never, you know, take anything for themselves, that leads to those pent-up feelings. But a person who sometimes gives in from time to time because they recognize that giving in to, you know, small things or giving in to people who are very important to them in specific circumstances, then a person doesn't feel like they're giving up on their own, you know, on their own rights, on their own being, on their own personality, because they've calculated that, you know, in certain circumstances, it's worth it to give in something because of the, you know, the importance of the relationship. But he says you might also go for lose-win if you feel the expense of time and effort to achieve a win of any kind would violate other higher values. Maybe it just isn't worth it. To go for a win sometimes might require so much effort that it's just not worth it. This is where I thank you, Jonathan, for pointing out that there may be very good sources here which relate to buying and selling of fields and stuff like that, where you could have disputes and people may decide not to pursue all their legal rights just because it's not necessarily worth it. So here's an example. The Gemara says in Baba Basra, Tahuda Amar Lechabri, a person said to his friend, my boy is Bahayara, what are you doing in my land? Amalei, your land, Mipranya Zavinta Vachalte Shanei Chazoka, what do you mean your land? I bought it from the other guy and I've been living here for years. Amalei, so the first guy said, Pranya Gazranahu, you bought it from the other guy. That other guy is a thief. It's my land. Amarei, if ha'isli sadi, the asis b'urta, the amisli zabna nihali. One second now. You're saying the other guy who sold it to me is a thief? But I have witnesses that you came to me last night and asked me to sell it to you. So how can you say that it's been your land the whole time and that the guy who sold it to me was a thief? You came yourself to try and buy it from me. Why would you come to try and buy it from me if you thought it was yours all along? So what did the guy say back? Amarei amina izbundinoi. I said that I would buy my court case, my fight. Amar Rava, Rava says, Avid Inish Dazavindine. He's allowed to say that. He's allowed to say, we would trust him as saying that he would rather pay than get involved in the whole fight. Now, all that does is mean that it's not a proof that he tried to come by it. We still have to discuss the case. Thank you for coming. So I will be in. We'll be in email touch.
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you.
This is wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate that. Be well, everybody.
Thank you. You too. And enjoy the trip.
Thank you.
Enjoy the trip. Yeah. So good night.
Following this, what does it mean to buy my litigation?
So I think what it means is I would rather pay than have to get involved in a prolonged court case dispute.
So he recognizes that it.
So he knew
that
it was his, but he's willing to buy it again
in order to avoid
arguing over that it actually was his.
Exactly,
okay.
Right. Yeah, I translated this, and it was a very loose translation, and I wasn't sure how to... Izbun dinai, the root of the word izbun, zavan, means to buy. The root of the word dinai means, dina means court case. So I'm not really sure how to best translate that into an English sentence.
Basically meaning that they can do a settlement of a court.
That's what he wanted.
Right.
He wanted to come to a settlement out of court,
right.
But the other guy apparently wasn't willing to sell it. And then he said, and I'll bring you proof that it's my field, because you acknowledge it's my field. You came to try to buy it from me. So the Gemara says the fact that he came to try and buy it is not proof that it's really not his. Right? We still have to discuss the court case. So who gets it? One guy says it was mine originally, the other guy says it wasn't. That's
right.
Still left, you know, that's still discussed there in the Gemara. But what we do know is the fact that he came to pay doesn't show that it's not his, because a person would be willing to pay to avoid having to get involved in the fight. And the Rashbam, here in Source 11, explains that. Avid Inish Dezavin Dine. Adam Tam, a person who's simple is not the right word, a peaceful person. She'ena Rotzel Hiskote, who doesn't like to fight. Afilu Al Shavo, he doesn't like fighting even for what's his. Asihu Rahotzi Ma'osav, he'll be willing to spend his money, Rito Es Shavo, just to get back what's his, Bero Dinu Machokas, without having to be involved in fights and arguments. Uveperish Rabbeinu Chananel Mefurash, Rabbeinu Chananel explains, Amina Remizbun Dinoi, what does it mean to buy my court case? Riknos hamarivos, I'll buy my fight, so to speak. Komar afal pishi sheli, even though it's mine, eni motzia miyado b'lo marivos, I would never be able to get it back without fights, v'dinin, and court cases. Ekna osam hadinim hamarivos, I'll buy those fights and court cases, be'elo amos, with this money, afal pishi ikar ha'aretz sheli. So here's an example where a person decided that even though it's mine, and it's rightfully mine, it's worth it for me to spend some money in order to avoid getting involved in the fight.
It's the same thing, 10 and 11.
Yeah, 11 is one of the commentaries on 10. It just explains it more fully. But yeah, correct, yeah. It's the same idea, same Gemara. And then there's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah which talks about one of the best tricks for getting God's forgiveness before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Sure.
The tricks. I mean, it's not so easy. I guess I shouldn't call it a trick. But the Gemara says, Ko ha-mavir al-midosav, anyone who basically is forgiving, right? He's not insistent on what's his. Mavir al-kol peshav, Hashem forgives him for all his sins. Shneemar nosei avon v'over al pesha. Remi nosei avon tehudas Hashem forgive. Remisha over al pesha to a person who himself is forgiving towards others. So we do see this idea that even though in general a person shouldn't always be conceding to everything, a person shouldn't just be trying to give everyone whatever they want just so that they can become, you know, more popular or more accepted. A person has to stand up for, you know, what they're entitled to, and, you know, a person is allowed to ask for what they have the right for. Nonetheless, sometimes it is beneficial to avoid fights by just giving in, by being forgiving. So that's lose-win. And the fourth category is lose-lose. So what's lose-lose? So he explains, lose-lose is nothing that is not something that people would want. So he explains what he means by lose-lose. Here on page 221, when two win-lose people get together, that is when two, so what does that mean, two win-lose people? That is when two determined, stubborn, ego-invested individuals interact, the result will be lose-lose. No one's going for lose-lose. Lose-lose is what happens when two very competitive people who insist on getting what they need both come together. So what happens? Both will lose. Both will become vindictive and want to get back or get even. Blind to the fact that murder is suicide, they try and get the other guy, they're harming themselves. That revenge is a two-edged sword. They get back at the other guy, they're harming themselves.
There's a, I'm not sure where in the Gemara, but it's somewhere, Kina Mekalkeles as Ashura, jealousy destroys logic.
I think that's thinking. Yeah.
Right, is this, I think this is an example.
Yes,
that, right?
For sure, yeah.
So when they're so emotional that it overrides
logic.
Yeah, overrides right. Logic. Yeah. So the hatred is so intense. Mm-hmm. Overrides logic.
Can't think straight.
Yeah.
They become so like revved up in their
right.
mind. I think the example of that is Bilam. That it says that when Bilam wanted to go curse the Jewish people, so he saddled his own donkey. So Bilam was a very important person. You know, kings would come to him for advice. Kings would come to him for blessings. He had plenty of people who could saddle his donkey for him. He was in such a rush to curse the Jewish people that he saddled his donkey and was on the way. So I think that's where they say that that because of those strong feelings, he just sort of didn't follow, you know, the normal etiquette, and he just, you know, was on the run. Yeah, for sure. Good. Should I write that down? Is it okay if I borrow your pen? Just one second, thank you. Just so that the next time I go through this, I can add in all the additional sources that people suggested.
In English, I think we would say call it being dafka.
Being medactic, yeah, exactly. Hashura. Thank you. Yeah, if I ever have the opportunity to say, thank you. If I ever have the opportunity to say these series of shiurim again, so we'll have all the additional sources that people added in along the way. Fine. So there are a few examples of this in the Gemara. One example here is the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The pasuk says, "Achar hadavar hazeh lo shav Yeravam midarko hara'ah." That Yeravam, who was one of the evil kings, he was a Jewish evil king, so he didn't go back from his evil ways. So my achar, what does it mean after all these things? He didn't, you know, return from his evil ways. After what? So Amar Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Abba explains, "Achar shetafsa haKadosh Baruch Hu Yeravam bevigdo." Hashem, God grabbed Yeravam by his clothing, so to speak. God grabs Yeravam, v'amara, when he says to him, "Chazor bach, just repent." Vaniva ata uben Yishai Natayel Began Eden. Me, you, and David HaMelech will go for a walk together in Gan Eden. Pretty good deal, right? Just repent, and you'll be on the level of David HaMelech. Amazing. I would have taken that deal. Amaro, Yeravam responds, Mi Barosh. Who's going to walk first? Hashem says, God says, Ben Yishai Barosh. David HaMelech is going to go first. So Yeravam says, Yihachi ro ba'ina. If that's the case, I'm not interested. So he gives up on a walk with God through Gan Eden because he's not willing to see David HaMelech come before him. I mean, he's such a win-lose that if he's going to be second, he's not interested in anything. Exactly.
Second. His way or no way.
Exactly, yeah. I have to have it my way or that's it. I'm not interested at all. Right. The next Gemara here was Daphne's idea. Thank you. So the Gemara in Gittin, the Gemara says, "Akamtza ubar kamtza charev Yerushalayim." Because of the dispute regarding Kamtza and Bar Kamtza, these were two different people who had very similar sounding names, and it resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem. What happened? Da'ahu gavra derachame Kamtza. There was a guy whose friend was Kamtza, ubar devave Bar Kamtza, and his enemy was Bar Kamtza. So it's confusing, right? One of his close friends is Kamtza, but one of his enemies is Bar Kamtza. So Avad Sudasa, he made a party. Amar Reshamoi, he told his servant, Zil Aisiri Kamtza, go bring me Kamtza, my friend, invite Kamtza. Azal Aisiri Bar Kamtza, the servant made a mistake and invited Bar Kamtza, right, the guy who's his enemy. So also Ashkechei to have a Yosef. So at the party, he's walking around the party and he finds that there's his enemy Bar Kamtza sitting at the party. Now, by the way, just to pause for a second, what was Bar Kamtza thinking? The enemy was invited to the party. He was probably thinking, this is beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like, he wants to make amends. Like, he's invited me to his party. Like, this is wonderful. The fact that he decided to show up almost shows that on his part, he's interested in developing a friendship. He's interested in getting back together, right? So what happened? Amar Lei, so the person who threw the party, said, Michti, Hahu Gavra Baal Devavot Hahu Gavrahu. One second, you're my enemy. My boy Yisachah, what are you doing here? Kum Puk, get up and leave. So Bar Kamtza was probably pretty shocked. He thought that the whole plan was to make amends. So Amar Lei, Hoil Vasoi Shavkan, once I'm already here, just let me stay, right? It'll be embarrassing to kick me out in front of everyone. I'll pay for the food that I eat. If you're worried about the expense of the food that I eat, I'll pay for it. Amar Lei, the person throwing the party, said, "Lo, no, I'm kicking you out of the party." Amar Lei, so Bar Kamtza said, I'll pay for half the party, just don't kick me out. Right, it's embarrassing to get kicked out. Amar Lei, Lo, he said, no, you have to leave. I don't even want to take payment for half the party. I'll pay for your entire party. No, you have to leave. He picked him up by the hand, stood him up, and brought him outside. He kicked him out physically. And what did Bar Kamtza say? He said, there were so many rabbis sitting at the party. How come no one stopped this person, the person throwing the party, from kicking me out? That's not right. You see that the rabbis were okay with what happened, and that's terrible. So, I'm going to go tell the king, I'm going to spread a libel to the king, and the king will come and take care of them. So, to make a long story short, he told the Caesar, and he got them in trouble. So, you see here, on multiple fronts, this perspective of, I have to win. First of all, the person who threw the party, right, here he had the opportunity to make amends, which was clear from the fact that his enemy was willing to show up. He had the opportunity to have the entire party paid for. All he had to do was not humiliate this guy publicly, and he still was so insistent on taking revenge that he was willing to do it at his own expense. And then on the other side, Bar Kamtza, who, you know, you sort of can feel bad for and identify with, you know, here he was trying to make amends coming to the party, but at the end of the day, he was humiliated by one individual, and some rabbis were present and didn't object, and he got the entire Jewish people in trouble in the eyes of the Caesar to the point where Jerusalem was destroyed. That's also not going to help him, right? So on both sides, you see that they were so interested in taking revenge that they caused just tremendous destruction to themselves. Fine. And then there's so many examples of this. One more example is, well, maybe for the sake of a sensitivity, if I'm going to be posting this online, maybe I'll leave this out because it's a little bit more of a touchy subject. But so I'm posting this here online, so I'll skip the next one because we already have enough sources that this is not a good idea. Fine. So and then perhaps the last example is a pasuk. The pasuk says, "Lo sikum, don't take revenge." And the Chizkuni explains here in Source 16, Rosikom Wafisha Hachema Mechabashtecha. I'm not trying to pronounce that Mechabashtecha, because anger can conquer you. Don't take revenge, because taking revenge is not only harmful for the person you're taking revenge against, but it's harmful for the person who takes revenge themselves. The anger will come back and conquer them. Fine. So basically what Kobi has done is he's described the four possibilities. He's shown how, you know, three of them are damaging. By win-lose, the competitive nature is damaging. Lose-lose is just when two win-lose people get together and fight. And lose-win when a person always gives in, so ultimately they feel like, you know, everything is pent up with inside of them and they're ready to explode. And really, the only viable option is win-win, where a person tries to, you know, synergizes his way of saying it, together with other people, and they come together and they try and find the best way for all of them to accomplish this third alternative. You know, and the ideal alternative for both of them. So then Kobi explains five dimensions of win-win, and we'll try and go through them in the time remaining. So the first one is character. So character he divides into three sections. The first is integrity. He says there's no way to go for a win-win in our own lives if we don't even know in a deep sense what constitutes a win. What is, in fact, harmonious with our innermost values? And this gets back to one of the previous chapters, right? Begin with the end in mind. Right? The habit of begin with the end in mind is I have to know what I value so that I know, you know, what to pursue in life. So that's the first step. In order to go for a win-win, you need to know what you consider to be a win. You know, what's a win for you? You know, what's in line with your values? You have to know your values. The second component of character is maturity. And the way he defines maturity, he says, is maturity is the balance between courage and consideration. The ability to express one's own feelings and convictions, balanced with consideration for the thoughts and feelings of others. And I'm not sure how to pronounce this person's name, but he's quoting from this professor, Harand Saxenian. Anyone know how to pronounce that? I'm not sure. Anyway, but the idea is that I have to stand up for myself while at the same time being considerate and sensitive for the feelings of others. Now, and that really comes up in the first, very first chapter in Shulchan Aruch, where it says in the very first chapter of Shulchan Aruch here in Source 17, "V'lo yisbayesh mipnei b'nei odom hamal'igim arav b'avodas Hashem yisbarach." If people pick fun of me while I'm serving Hashem, while I'm serving God, you know, they say, why are you being so religious? Why do you have to serve God? People pick fun of me, so I shouldn't be embarrassed. I let them pick fun of me. It doesn't embarrass me. I know what I'm doing is right. But explains the Mishnah Brura here in Source 18, "Mipnei b'nei adam v'alko panim lo yiskot edimayim." But don't start arguing with them and fighting with them. "Mipnei shemidas ha'azus maguna ma'od." This trait of brazenness is a very bad trait. "V'ein ro'oy reshtamish v'mena k'chal." It should never be used. "Afilu b'avodas Hashem yisbarach." Even in the service of God. Because a person then is going to acquire this trait of brazenness and they're going to use it in other contexts. Meaning, even though in theory, as a standalone, it might make sense to turn to those people who are picking fun of me for being religious and to say to them, no, being religious is the right thing to do. Even though, you know, in that particular situation that might make sense, the Mishnah Brura says, don't do that. Because then a person is going to become brazen in other contexts. And outside of religious contexts, it's even inherently problematic to have that approach. So even though a person should, you know, follow their convictions and do what they believe to be right, they're not supposed to fight with people who are picking fun of them. They're supposed to be, you know, to some degree, understanding of, you know, the perspective that the other people are coming from. And even though that shouldn't impede, you know, what, you know, their own projects and the things that, you know, they believe is right, they believe to be right, nonetheless, they should, you know, treat the other people with respect and not just, you know, fight with them and argue with them. That's really an expression of this idea that it's important to express one's own feelings and convictions, but that has to be balanced with the consideration for the thoughts and feelings of others. And the third point that Covey lists, the third dimension of character, is abundance mentality. The third character trait essential to win-win is the abundance mentality, the paradigm that there's plenty out there for everybody. In other words, there's no need for competition because there's enough out there for all of us. The Gemara says here in Maseches Yoma, here in Source 19, "B'shimcha yikra'ucha," they'll call you by your name, "uvimkomcha yoshivucha," they'll sit you in your place, in a positive way, "umishalcha yitnulecha," and they will give you what's yours, meaning don't be afraid of, you know, being deprived of what you should be called, being deprived of sitting in your place, being deprived of what should be yours. You will be called what you're, you will be called by your name, you will be sat in your place, what you're, you know, what you're deserving of, "umishalcha yitnulecha," you'll receive what's yours, don't be afraid anyone's gonna take that away from you, "ein adam nogea b'muchan l'chaveiro," no one can take away from what's prepared for one's friends, "v'ein malchus nogas b'chaverta afilu k'malaynima," and no kingdom can encroach on another even by a hair's breadth, you know, when it's time for one kingdom to end and the next to begin, so that's what God arranges. Everyone gets what's theirs, no one has to worry about something being taken from them. The next source here basically points out that that the expression that that even a hair's breadth is reminiscent of a Gemara, which basically says that God told Eov that God sees to it that every hair comes out of its, you know, its guma, of its hole that the hair emerges from, and doesn't deprive any other hairs of their sustenance from one's head. So that's really an example for this idea that no one's going to take away from what's yours. Each person has their own source of sustenance, and they're going to receive, you know, what they're going to receive. No one's going to take away from them. And we know that one of the Aseres Hadibros, right here in Source 21, is L'sachmod Beis Re'echa. Don't be jealous of what your friend has, right? The pasuk list, don't be jealous of your friend's house, don't be jealous of your friend's wife, of your friend's servants, of your friend's ox, donkey, or anything that your friend owns. And one of the Mefarshim, one of the commentaries, explains there that the best way to, how can God say not to be jealous? It's human nature to be jealous. So he explains, is anyone ever jealous of a bird's wings? A bird can fly. Wouldn't it be nice to fly? No one's jealous of a bird's wings because we recognize we're people, they're birds, that belongs to a bird, that's a trait that a bird has. Listen, the bird would love to be us in a lot of other ways, you know? So the same way that no one's jealous of a bird because they realize the bird has what he needs, I have what I need. So too, that's the perspective that we should have, even amongst other people. They have what they need, I have what I need, and I don't need to worry about them taking it away from me. The fact that they have it doesn't mean that somehow I'm being deprived of it. I have what, you know, what I need. The next source, the Chovos HaRabavos, here basically explains that one of, I'm just rushing for the sake of time, that that one of the things, one of the amazing things that God did in creating the world was he made sure that those things which are more necessary for survival are in greater quantity, and therefore air is available for everyone. Water is in great quantity. Food is in a little less quantity than water. Water is in a little less quantity than air. Things that are the least necessary, like, for example, you know, like things like gold and silver, I think he discusses. We don't really need gold and silver to live on. They've become like a currency. So with that, some people have more of than others. But that's because we don't really need it. Things that a person really needs were created with the quantity necessary, you know, for human survival. Fine. So that's all the first of the five dimensions of win-win, character. The second is relationships. So Covey writes, from the foundation of character, we build and maintain win-win relationships. The trust, the emotional bank account, is the essence of win-win. And he explained in previous chapters what he means by the emotional bank account. When we do favors for people, when we have positive interactions with people, we, so to speak, build an emotional bank account. So that then, you know, there's mutual respect. I view them favorably, they view me favorably. And then if someone does something wrong to the other person, so that's a that's some withdrawal from the emotional bank account. But they've made so many deposits by doing so many things for the other person that they're still way ahead. So that's expressed here in the Pasuk in Mishlei. The Pasuk says, Sinat ta'orer midanim, that hatred inspires fighting. Va'al kol pisha'im techaseh ahava, but for all, that all sins are covered up by love. And the Matudas David explains that in the next source, that hasina sheyesh la'adam al-mi, that hatred that a person has for someone, hima oreres midanim, that inspires fights, rasos meriva ulahakwid al davar kal, for every small thing I'll get upset, because I hate them anyways. We start with such a low, you know, level of trust, the emotional bank account is so low, because they've done so many things to me in the past, that the smallest thing, you know, causes me to explode. Aval avas adam lechaveiro, but when I love him, techasa al kol dvar pesha, so that'll cover up for anything he does wrong. He does something wrong to me, no big deal, because I love him, because we've developed such a trust and such a love. Then the Matzudas David ends, I'm trying to figure out how to translate this, Aval yakbid af al davar kasha. It sounds like a person still might get upset if there's something, you know, that's done that's very significantly bad. In other words, you know, I guess different things that a person can do can be, to different degrees, withdrawals or deposits in the emotional bank account. If I do a huge favor for someone, you know, if I do something terrible to someone, that can, you know, have much greater effect than something minor. But the point is that if there's a, if the emotional bank account is high, there's a lot of trust and there's a lot of love, then that covers up for small mistakes. The next dimension is agreements. So Covey writes, creating win-win performance agreements requires vital paradigm shifts. The focus is on results, not methods. Most of us tend to supervise methods. With win-win accountability, people evaluate themselves. The traditional evaluation games people play are awkward and emotionally exhausting because you're like judging the other person, and that feels bad for both people. In win-win, people evaluate themselves using the criteria that they themselves helped to create up front. And if you set it up correctly, people can do that. Now, the following is a very interesting example. None of my teachers, as far as I know, ever did this with me. But maybe they did, and I just can't remember it. But it's an amazing, you know, if this works, which, you know, it sounds like it would. Good thing for teachers to know. My best experiences in teaching university classes have come when I have created a win-win shared understanding of the goal up front. This is what we're trying to accomplish. Here are the basic requirements for an A, a B, or a C grade. My goal is to help every one of you get an A. Now you take what we've talked about and analyze it and come up with your own understanding of what you want to accomplish and that is unique to you. Then let's get together and agree on the grade you want and what you plan to do to get it. In other words, like create your own syllabus, you know? You decide the grade, you decide what it's appropriate to do to get that grade, run it by me, and if it makes sense, then that's the plan. So, amazing. So the idea that a person who holds themselves accountable will be more effective is expressed in the Gemara in Brachos here in Source 25. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan mishum Rabbi Yosi, tova mardos achas b'ribo shel adam yoser mikama malchios. That one, I'm not sure how to best translate this, Rashi here in Source 26 translates mardos achas lashon ridui v'hachna, a certain humility, shel adam sam aribo me'erav, that a person realizes on their own. So a sense of humility and a realization that a person has on their own is more effective than kama malchios, than getting whipped. Meaning the threat of punishments, cannot accomplish as much as a person's own realization. Shene'emar, as the pasuk says, v'radfas me'ahaveha, that a person may run after someone, after other people who they love, who they shouldn't be running after because they're married, v'amra, and then eventually they come to the realization and they say, elchove ashuva el ishi harishon, I'll return to my original spouse, ki tovli az me'ata, because that was better for me than running, you know, after all these other people. Meaning the person, this is referring to the Jewish people. The Jewish people were running after idols, and the parable given is that it's like a person who's married, who while they're married is running after other people, and they eventually realize, I'm married, I should be with my spouse, and that's like the Jewish people who realized that they were running after idols, and they realized, no, I should be with God. Right, and that realization is more powerful than all the punishments. Reish Lakish Amar Yoser Mimea Malchios, more so than 100 whippings. Shneimar Techaska Rabbi Mevin Mehakos Ksil Maya. That this literally Gaara means to yell, but a certain recognition for one who has understanding is greater than hitting a fool 100 times. In other words, one's own recognition is the most effective. And the next section he has here in the five components to win-win is systems. I did not think of any source for it, so anyone who has ideas, please let me know. He says here on page 217, as with many, many problems between people in business, family, and other relationships, the problem in this company was the result of a flawed paradigm. He described what the situation was, but the main point is the following sentence. The president was trying to get the fruits of cooperation from a paradigm of competition. In other words, if you basically reward people for doing better than other people, so then you're setting up competition. So then this president of this company was upset. They're not working together. How come they're not working together? Well, of course they're not working together if you say that you're going to give an extra bonus to the one person who does better than everyone else. So if you want to get cooperation, you have to reward cooperation. You can't reward competition and then expect to get cooperation. And along those lines, he says here on page 240, win-win can only survive in an organization when the systems support it. If you talk win-win but reward win-lose, you've got a losing program on your hands. You basically get what you reward. If you want to achieve the goals and reflect the values in your mission statement, then you need to align the reward system with these goals and values. And listen to the following experiment. Out of the 800 people there, this was a company that gave out awards. Out of the 800 people there, around 40 received awards for top performance. Only 40 out of the 800. At the next rally 1 year later, there were over 1,000 sales associates present, and about 800 of them received rewards. That's because Covey got involved in this company and arranged that they would change their system. There were a few individual winners based on comparisons, but the program primarily focused on people achieving self-selected performance objectives and on groups achieving team objectives. The remarkable thing was that almost all of the 800 who received the awards that year had produced as much per person in terms of volume and profit as the previous year's 40. In other words, 4/5 of the company now was producing on the same level as the 40 people were the previous year because they were being rewarded based on their own goals and not based on competitive goals. The spirit of win-win had significantly increased the number of golden eggs and had fed the goose as well. That's going back to the mashal, the parable that he had given in the first chapter, releasing enormous human energy and talent. The resulting synergy was astounding to almost everyone involved. So I wasn't able to find a direct source for this idea, but the closest is that we say in the Rosh Hashanah davening, in the Matzor, that Hashem judges us, Masa ish ufkudaso, a person's actions and pekudaso. What's pekudaso? So pekudaso means his mission. A person is judged based on how their actions live up to their mission. We don't say in Rosh Hashanah, I'm judged based on how my actions live up to the most righteous person's actions. I'm judged not based on comparison. On Rosh Hashanah, God judges us based on how our actions live up to our mission. So that's this idea. We shouldn't judge ourselves and we shouldn't judge others, you know, in comparison to other people in a competitive nature. It should be in comparison to what a person, you know, is capable of accomplishing. The next two, there are two more components that he adds underneath the rubric of win-win, and those are going to be the next two chapters, Habits 5 and Habit 6, so we'll leave that for then.